I said, you know, it's important because of this and that and their songs and who they used to be with. And I said, and people are really looking to see what I do first as an A&R guy. And Kenny just stopped and looked at me and said, no, they're not, buddy. Don't be a wanker. And I was so embarrassed and ashamed and just, oh, I'm such a dick.
I'm Stephen Mark Foltz, and you're listening to 321 Disaster. Successful people tell their stories of failure. Because in life, failure isn't just an option, it's unavoidable. We talk with successful inventors, entrepreneurs, artists, performers, and scientists about the times, and we all have them, they weren't so successful. Celebrating failure as a necessary but all too often hidden part of the creative process. Not talking about failure warps our view of the way the world works and of how innovation really happens. Sharing our stories gives us a fuller picture of what life is like and helps us understand the way progress is really made. Cherche pas d'horreur dans mes cris de douleur. Les larmes qui coulent ne sont pas loin de retrouver. Today, part two of my interview with Hugo Burnham, the original drummer for the legendary post-punk band Gang of Four. Last time, Hugo talked about how they launched their career by bluffing their way into opening for the Buzzcocks.
I should have sometimes said, hello, we're the opening act. No, you're not. Yes, we are. No, you're not. Yes. Can we be?
About the violence that was endemic to the punk music scene in the 1970s and 80s.
Big beer bottle came crashing down on his head.
And how Gang of Four got themselves kicked off Top of the Pops, the biggest pop music show in the UK, without ever playing a note.
We walked out of Top of the Pops, and we felt very self-righteous. We were absolutely right and correct, and we completely buggered our career.
Today, Hugo talks about how the band broke up, how they reunited 20 years later, and then broke up again.
You know, and eventually it sort of fell apart again.
And did it fell apart in the same way? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, with a lot of exacerbation from the manager.
About his post-performing career as a manager and A&R man.
So at some point you became the band's manager, is that right?
Yeah.
How'd that work?
Not terribly well.
About almost, but not quite, meeting his idol, David Bowie.
So why didn't you say hello to him?
Because he was... I don't know. I just didn't want to be a fanboy.
And about his regrets.
I regret not being more aggressive to stand up for the right things to be done.
But first, we talked about the second chance Gang of Four had to be on Top of the Pops, how they got themselves invited back, and how they got booted from the show again, once more, before they even played a note.
Of course, you know, the next time we were invited on top... next single that was climbing the charts a couple of years later was I Love a Man in a Uniform, which, you know, it was sort of piss-taking about militarism, of course, and it was all highly sarcastic. But, you know, witty, ironic, all that sort of thing. And, again, the company thought, actually, we've got something here. Time with my girl, I spent it well. Week we were going into the charts, and Margaret Thatcher declared war on Argentina over the Malvinas Islands, the Falkland Islands.
Mr. Speaker, sir, the House meets this Saturday to respond to a situation of great gravity. We are here because for the first time for many years, British sovereign territory has been invaded by a foreign power.
And the word went to the BBC, we don't want anything about militarism. What? They said what? Again?
So that was just bad luck timing, the second one.
Yeah, it was.
If the history of rock music teaches nothing else, it teaches that more often than not, great bands break up. And for Gang of Four, that started when bassist Dave Allen quit.
I think the pressure personally had got to him too much, and he was had a couple of weeks of feeling very low.
Yeah.
And being, he was not in good shape. And he said, I can't do this. I'm going to die if I keep doing it.
Yeah.
You know. So he left, and it was devastating. And it's like we had a sold out, six sold out shows to go to the West Coast starting in 5 days. What do we do? So,
what did you
and
do?
It was very sad. I mean, yeah, John and Angie were angry. I was sad.
Yeah.
You know, but I got it.
Dave Allen's leaving the band wasn't just sad. It also presented the immediate problem of what to do without a bass player with six already sold out shows on the West Coast happening in a matter of days. Amazingly, thanks to the heroics of Talking Heads bass player Busta Cherry Jones, who came in at the very last minute and pulled off, in one day, what all the other pros had said was impossible, they made it.
After working through three other people who said, yeah, I can do this, really well-known bass players.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's like, what, in 3 days? 2 days?
Yeah.
And Busta Cherry Jones, the bass player from Talking Heads, who'd also played with Brian Eno and Sharks, his our A&R guy at Warner Brothers called over there and said, hey, is he working, Gang of Four?
Right.
And he said, yeah, yeah, I can do it. So he came, he met with us, fantastic guy, great fun, and we gave him tapes of the songs and said, you know, see you in SIR at 12 o'clock tomorrow morning. And Andrew just said, if he doesn't get the first two songs down pretty, I'm quitting, I'm done, we're not doing it. But he came in the next morning and he knew every song. Or if he was so, you know, he had a little Walkman beside his ear playing along with it. And we had the whole thing done in a day. And we flew to Seattle and we played the Music Box, I think it was.
In a day? Big,
yeah, we rehearsed for a day.
Right, but I mean, he
flew out.
He picked up his bass, walked in, and a day later he was playing with you guys and was okay with it.
Yeah.
The speed with which Jones learned Gang of Four's music was amazing. But when he found himself on stage, he discovered that there was one element of performing with the band that he hadn't prepared for.
And we got to the Music Box in Seattle. I think Three Swimmers were opening for us. But anyway, big, sort of in the round theater, packed, very tense. And we came on stage and it was like, okay, we started and it was good and the audience were right there. And after about the second song, John and Andrew started that, okay, we've got this, started there. Running up and down and bashing into each other. And Buster just looked back at me and said, what the fuck's going on? I said, get in there. I literally screamed, get in there. And he charged at them. And it was like, they were, what? Oh, okay. Because this is what this is what the stage thing was, right? Just like being completely, quite physically aggressive in a somewhat theatrical way. But, you know, it was.
But there was real contact, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, God,
right.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it was fantastic. Seattle, Vancouver, Portland, San Francisco, L.A., and San Diego. And it was great. So
we sort of pulled out of the fire.
Yeah, it was good. And then he didn't stay with us, sadly. I mean, his manager was asking for a lot of money. Plus, he lived in New York. And we had, the alternative was an old friend from back in Ali's days, Sarah Lee, who'd been playing since then with various people, including Robert Fripp, the League of Gentlemen, and we knew them. We'd been hanging out with them, and he just called and said, "Sarah Lee, you have to go with Sarah Lee. She's the one. I'm telling you, you trust me, Sarah Lee." So we got Sarah in. She didn't join as a full partner, but as a sort of paid partner. But
how did that work? With the physicality, how big was she?
She wasn't very big.
I was going to say, there's a lot of bumping around.
Yeah, she sort of kept out of that a bit. So when that all started, she just looked around and gently, sort of stepped back towards the rear of the stage, go up downstage away from that. But that was fine.
So at some point, you became the band's manager. Is that right?
Yeah.
How'd that work?
Not terribly well.
How did it happen?
Okay, it happened because our first manager, who got us into the record business and everything, who was a friend, Rob Waugh, he left because it was getting too fractious for him, and he had an opportunity to go and take an executive position at EMI Records. He actually became our label manager. And his assistant, if you like, Linda Neville, who was a friend and had been working in the running the office, we just thought, oh, great, we've got an opportunity to have a woman manager now. This is a good thing to do. So yeah. We did. And, you know, like all of us, probably not as business savvy as could have been. And we were all distracted by the sort of lifestyle we were leading and everything. And there were some horrendous mistakes made. Our responsibility entirely, because we were just not really paying attention as much as possible.
What kind of mistakes?
Well, we were on a tour in the States and hadn't work permits hadn't been got. So we went up to Canada and came back, and they wouldn't let our crew in because they didn't have work permits. Right. It's like, what? So they all were sent home. We got to New York.
To the UK?
To the UK, right. Yeah, except our lighting guy, right. Ray. Rayo Lights, because he actually was an American citizen, yeah. Even though he was English. So he got in, and we just had to, I think our sound guy then snuck back in,
Jesus.
Took a flight, came in, you know, because we couldn't really do it without Kevin, because he was such an integral part of yeah. The live sound. So while we were looking for management, I said, well, let's let me do it, because I spent most of my free time at the record label, at EMI yep. or at our agent's office, just because I liked hanging out there. I yep. was absorbing stuff. I liked to know what was going on a bit more. And that it didn't go terribly well, because I think there's a – what do you mean you needed 6 calls to make this happen?
Yeah.
It was a – I thought it was partly willful lack of understanding of how the business works. Right. And I think it was just prior to – the two of them wanting to have, if you like, a duopoly rather than a triumvirate
yeah.
of power. And further division when we tried a number of different managers, and the best company yeah. that we could have had in the world wanted to manage us very badly. And John and Andrew balked at it because one of the partners, well, he likes heavy metal too much. It's like, oh, my God, this is the best management team in the world. This could help us because right. we've stalled.
Right.
And we need some professional right. help and guidance. But we were collectively quite sort of arrogant about what we knew what we were doing. Yeah. And we did a lot of things, but rather typical of a lot of musicians, it's, well, I'm a good songwriter, therefore I must be good at directing videos and doing artwork. Yeah. Although John and Andrew were very good at artwork. But,
yeah.
You know, so I did that for a year. We finally chose a manager who Warner Brothers Records in L.A. basically flew me out there to do 2 things, oversee a remix of I Love a Man in a Uniform
yeah.
and also to have meetings with me. And they said, we love you guys. We want to have a long relationship with you. And, of course, it's entirely your decision who you choose as a manager. But if you choose this one person,
right.
we'll be very disappointed. Stupidly, I went back and told the others that's what they said. So it was like waving a rag in front right. of a bull. So we went with him. And within, and then 2 months later, I was out of the band entirely. Yeah. And 2 years later, they got rid of him because he'd been stealing money from them.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. Made them sign a publishing, co-publishing or a sub-publishing deal with him. And it's just like the classic
yeah.
musician cock-ups.
Yeah. So when you guys split up, was the feeling that there wasn't equal contribution?
Well, it wasn't about not being equal contribution. Okay. It was really a power play. And, and as John said, he said, I'm just tired of arguing everything.
Yeah. And it sounds like there was a lot of arguing just throughout your history. Some yeah. of which was creative.
Much of which was creative.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But, we were frustrated commercially
yeah.
and personally frustrated in many ways because we were, at one point the next big thing and
right. –
because of bad business decisions, we weren't getting anywhere.
Right.
You know, we were just doing the same
right.
1,200, 2,000 seat theaters and yeah. clubs and, making money on the road, but not getting radio hits
right.
and not growing
right.
as much as a lot of our contemporaries were, who were completely outstripping us.
Yeah.
So.
And did you look at them and feel like they're no better than we are? Why are they moving ahead and we're not?
Well. Yes.
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 Yeah.
We do great work.
Yeah.
What's going on? But that's what we lacked by not having what I would have said was, management that we trusted, who knew what they were doing, who could push back. you know, right. Our first A&R guy, the guy who signed us to EMI at the beginning, had left. And we liked and trusted him. And he was very hands-off, but smart enough to know, say, yeah, that sucks. Or, yeah, do that. Because it doesn't matter how good you are, you need some sort of bounce back of ideas. Yeah. And very often that's between all of you, but you know, dynamics change, people change, money changes people.
I'm Stephen Mark Voltz, and you're listening to 321 Disaster. As Hugo became more involved being the band's manager, he was less and less involved in creating the music, and that led to him being edged out of ownership of the songs, which led to some hard feelings.
Charlie Watts gets a cut. You two, I believe, share everything equally to this day.
He explains how that all played out.
By that time, I wasn't as involved in the creative side of it at all.
Yeah. How did you feel about that? Becoming more of a...
Well, I was very involved in the management side of things. Right. And I was, you know, I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
But suddenly it's like, oh, what, you mean I'm not getting publishing? Even though I've been working these songs with you and everything else. Yeah. So it was, there's lots of tentacles of dissatisfaction and change. And it could have been done. I mean, I ended up, I think, you know, it's like, well, of course we recognize everything else. So you get 10%. I think I had 15% instead of 25 or something like that. But, you know, that's what happens.
That must have been tough.
Should have been organized before we went into it.
Yeah.
Not one penny should ever be made that doesn't get split to some percentage to everybody.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, you know, singer-songwriters, they get all the money and the rhythm section don't get anything. It's like, why is this? This is wrong. And I Squeeze were ones like that, you know.
Yeah.
Diffin and Tilbrook were making hundreds of thousands more than the rest of the band. Yeah. It's just like, You can't do this, which is why they eventually split up, or one of the reasons, you know.
What?
Charlie Watts gets a cut. You two, I believe, share everything equally to this day.
Yeah.
And how long have they stayed together? Yep. You know, I don't know. It's you can't be mean to the people who've, you know, swum through the same puke as you have for years and. You know, being in the same van overnight.
After Hugo was edged out of Gang of Four, he found himself working as a tour manager for other bands.
And then actually I sort of fell into tour management because my brother had gone on to work for another management company who managed Blancmange and Shriekback. Shriekback being the band that Dave, who'd left us, had formed with Barry Andrews from XTC and League of Gentlemen and Carl Marsh from Out on Blue Six. And they were really building their own thing. And Jolyon used to tour manage them, and he said, oh, I've got to go off to America with Blancmange. Would you do this long week in Europe with Shriekback? And I needed money. I was, it'll be fun. And back on the road with Dave. So I did. And after we, literally on the ferry coming home after 5 days, they said, well, we're going to fire our manager. Will you be our manager? And we got a tour of America coming up. And I was like, yes. Well, and right before then, I'd also been doing some session work. I'd been doing session work with a real sort of top 20 pop star called Samantha Fox.
Yeah.
I'd been on Top of the Pops with Public Image Limited. And I did about 6 months working with ABC on with their second album. That was then, but this is now. I did the videos. I did all the TV shows, went to Japan with them and Europe doing. So, and they had actually said they were getting rid of their manager and had found they had a manager in the US but wanted somebody to look after Europe. So they asked me to look after them literally the same week. So it's like, oh, okay.
And I just thought, how long did you manage?
I didn't manage ABC. I said, I love you, but the lure of going on the road and working with Shriekback, it was the difference between being in the French court or out on at war with the Visigoths. And I chose the latter. And it really was. Oh, my God. I don't know how many of us are alive today. Not many sober moments on that tour.
After Shriekback decided to disband, Hugo went to work for Island Records as an A&R man.
Describe what an A&R person does, what you were doing.
An A&R person is basically a talent scout and the fixer, if you like, within...
Oh, also just A&R stands for?
Alcohol and recreation. I mean, Artists and repertoire. Yeah. In the old school, it was the person who would put the artists together with the songs and also was very often the producer.
Right.
Jerry Wexler.
Right.
So I did that at Ireland. Then I went, I was there 2 years, I said. Then I went to Imago, Terry Ellis's label. And I was in LA about a year, and then I actually was fired by the head of A&R, who was having... She's a very dear friend now, but it was a very difficult time for her then. So, but I ended up being offered a job before that actually happened by Quincy Jones. Well, the guy that ran his label, Quest Records. The head of Alternative and Rock A&R for Quest Records, which was a division of Warner Brothers.
Right.
And that was I did that for 3 years. That was fantastic.
And then at some point there was a reunion.
Yeah, there was. One thing I do want to say, because we're talking about, you know, things you regret,
mess up
something. Yeah. My first A&R job at Island Records, the first band I signed were great, sort of hard rock, not heavy metal, but definitely hard rock band. Yeah. And the manager and I were talking to various publishers on their behalf, you know, tried to get them a publishing deal, co-publishing deal. And one of them was a good friend, a Scotsman, who was one of the major publishers at Warner Chappell Publishing. And we had a meeting with him, and I was, I said, you know, it's important because of this and that and their songs and who they used to be with. And I said, and people are really looking to see what I do first as an A&R guy. And Kenny just stopped and looked at me and said, no, they're not, buddy. Don't be a wanker. And I was so embarrassed and ashamed and just, I'm such a dick. Because I was taken with solipsism and thinking this was partly about me. And it didn't mean a thing.
Yeah.
And it was one of the best sort of lessons I had. But God, at the time, I felt so small and stupid. But that's good for people every now and again.
It definitely helped change.
Yeah. Oh, terrible.
Yeah.
But it was a great lesson learned, and I didn't make that mistake again. It's nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, my history was important when I was selling myself as an A&R guy and my label to potential acts that I wanted to sign. It's like, you know, I'm a musician. I've been on the road. I've done all these things that you are doing or wanting to do. You know, I can talk to you. I can share. It means something. Yeah, it did. So,
absolutely.
So I got myself some perspective about myself.
Yeah.
But, oh, God, it stung at the time. I felt like such a twat. Anyway.
Ouch.
One of my many mistakes.
I'm Stephen Mark Voltz, and you're listening to 3-2-1 Disaster. In the early 2000s, bands like the Pixies and Mission of Burma were having success with reunion tours, and people began urging Gang of Four to get back together as well. But resentment from the way Dave Allen had quit and left the band in the lurch in the middle of their 1980 U.S. tour still lingered. Hugo, though, was adamant that the only way to do a reunion tour was with all four of the band's original members, and that meant Dave, too. So he went to London and talked to Andrew and John, and then talked to Dave.
It had been sort of talked about, should we do something again? He's not talking to him, or nobody wants to deal with Dave anymore because he ran out on us the first time. But then there was a lot of pressure from a lot of people in the big. Look, everyone sounds like you again.
Right.
You should go out and show them how it sounds. Look at the Pixies, they're making millions.
Right.
So anyway, I went to London that summer, met with Andrew and John. And they were very loath to get Dave involved because I said, we can't do this unless it's the original four. Right. Otherwise, it has not anything like as much credibility.
Right.
And anyway, I sort of worked it all. November, we all got together in London and had a meeting with Andrew was now a producer, the guitar player. It was at his manager's office. He was neither my nor Dave's choice to manage us, but we got ourselves sort of cornered and bullied into accepting that.
Yeah.
And he was a nasty little man, really unpleasant.
Yeah.
Been very successful, but a real arsehole.
Yeah.
And I, you know, again, like the last time about the management thing, John and Andrew pushed and he buggered them up in the end. You know, I was right again. But I won't say that out loud because then I'll come back to bite me, like thinking it was all about me with Kenny. Anyway, but we decided we'd do it.
I think there's a from what I've been hearing, there's a history of a lot of bad decisions. Yeah. A lot of great work and then a lot of bad decisions. And for at least some of those bad decisions, there were votes taken. Yeah. And you were in the minority, I think.
I was in the minority fairly often. But that I'm not drawing conclusions that I was smarter than anyone else. But I, certainly on the business thing, the business side of things and the third parties we would tie ourselves to, I believe I had a better instinct than the other two.
You can't go back and replay it because you don't know what would have happened if it had gone your way. But
it would have been much better if it had all gone my way. Yeah. We'd have been much more successful.
All right. So everyone agrees to do this reunion.
Yeah.
Of course, Hugo hadn't been drumming for several years at that point. So there was some question about whether he still had his chops.
But it was tough. It was like we can't just go out and do this half-heartedly. We have a great legacy and a reputation of being ferociously good live. We're all 30 years, 20-some years old. You know, we're all turning 50.
So this is 2005?
2005. This was in 2004 for 2005.
Right.
So I came home and it's like, Christ, I better start playing again.
Yeah.
So I I booked a rehearsal room for 2 weeks in Medford, I think it was, or Somerville.
Yeah.
And I took the record in and I put it on the PA system in the rehearsal room and I started playing along to it. And it was awful. It was hell. It was too fast. It hurt. And I was in a terrible state of, I had no self-confidence about being able to do this. And I was going to show, I didn't care about showing them up. I cared about showing my, no, I did. I just didn't. But literally after about 8 days of this, muscle memory started to kick in. I felt right, yes. And it was muscle memory and the fact that I was playing again, rehearsing again.
Yeah.
So I did that, and then we all got together literally.
Don't go too quick through that.
I'm sorry.
I want to dwell on the pain there for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, eight days of you must have been playing, what, 6 or 7, 8 hours?
Oh, no. Three or four hours.
3 or 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
Right.
And
how do you keep going when you know you're listening to the record and you're playing and you're hearing what you're doing?
You cry.
And it's not matching.
You burst blisters.
And the clock is ticking.
You put bandages around your fingers.
And you go back the next day.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was over 3 weeks, but I did about 10 to 12 days. I'd have days off and things.
To heal up.
To heal up and wonder what the hell I was doing.
Yeah.
And it really is like, okay, I can do this. Oh, right, this is how I used to do it.
Did you get a call from that terrible manager in the middle of that?
Well, he kept calling saying, they think they need another drummer. The boys don't think you can do it, which was what he kept harping on when we re-recorded all the songs, which I wasn't a part of. Because he didn't really care about me or Dave.
Right.
Largely because Dave and I both stayed in the music industry and could battle back at him about things and because we were in the States. And the main drive for him was re-energizing Andrew's career as a producer. That the resurgence of interest in the Gang of Four would help his and good fair that's enough legit, yeah lovely yeah, no legit. Problem legit right but he was trying to engineer everything. He tried to get us, Dave and I, kicked off all the publishing. He said we're going to change the publishing. It's Dave and I just like no actually fucking not well we're, it's like no we still have publishing deals is that right. Don't bother
right.
But it was very aggressive at first.
So and in the middle of the 8 days of misery when you're not up to speed and you don't know if you can make it, you're getting calls from this guy saying, we don't think you can do it.
Are you practicing enough? You know, you need to lose weight. Really completely trying to break me down in order because he had some kid he used to manage who was a drummer who he wanted to slide in.
Right. And then it starts to turn and your muscle memory's kicking in and then how does that feel?
Really good. But really good.
But you realize you can do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Then we went to London. We rehearsed for a week together in Andrew's studio.
Yeah.
Came home for 3 days, went back and did like a 10-day UK tour.
How was that?
It was great.
All right. How were the shows?
Great. Manchester, the penultimate show in Birmingham before We went did the big London show. It was awful. There weren't that many people, 400 or 500. It should have been double that. But and one of us got horrendously, horribly drunk and played really, really poorly. And that really upset someone else who said, "That's it. I'm done. I'm not doing this. I'm not coming to America." And I was like, "Jesus Christ! No, you can't do this. Everything's this is going to be great." Talked him down. But the person who got drunk and played appallingly, that became a sort of rolling habit every sort of 10 shows or so. And it was very stressful to deal with. And then there were other decisions, you know, I think the first American tour, somebody else got in, a tour manager who just, I guess, like a coke fiend. Yep. And it's like, what? Now, is this still going? People say, "Oh, come on." You know, and he lost the tour accounts, and he did just a lot of, you know, he came across, "Oh, I'm going to get this for you, I'm going to get that for you," and it was all very frustrating.
Yeah.
It took forever to get him to share the projected tour budget, and I started going through it, because that's what I'd done for years.
Right.
And I was told to shut up and mind my own business. It's like, this isn't for you, you just drum.
Yeah.
And again, of course, you know, there was a lot of money spent that need not have been spent.
Yeah.
So that was frustrating. But the shows on stage when it was just the four of us together. I mean, when we went off to Europe the first time, after the shows, there was one night in Amsterdam, the four of us just went out together, and it was so much fun.
Yeah.
Just the four of us together, drinking, laughing.
Yeah.
The good moments were spectacular, because most people don't get one shot, and here we were enjoying our second shot at this and doing it really well.
Right.
So yeah, it was terrific. We were very lucky to have the chance, and we did it right.
Yeah.
As far as audiences were concerned, and eventually it sort of fell apart again.
And did it fall apart in the same way? Or
Yeah. I mean, with a lot of exacerbation from the manager.
Yeah.
And then
Gang of Four had some stellar successes, but they never achieved what some of their contemporaries did. I asked Hugo, looking back, what he regretted.
I regret not being more aggressive to stand up for the right things to be done, but I was again in the minority.
In that reunion or all throughout?
Yeah, in the reunion.
Yeah.
Not creatively, but certainly as far as all the business was being done.
At that point, you knew more.
I knew a lot more.
Yeah.
But
what would you have said?
Well, I did say, and I was shut down.
Yeah. You know,
things like the budget, things like what we're doing. And you don't just tell me what you're going to do as always, it's lack of communication.
Yeah.
Don't just assume, "Oh, we're doing this, and you've got to be here."
Already.
It's
we
need to talk to each other about the plans. You don't just talk to Andrew, talk to all of us.
Right.
Because we are a band. Right. Dave and I are not Andrew's backing band. We're not his session players.
Right. Who are your influences coming up?
As a drummer?
As a musician, as a drummer, what?
Free.
Yeah.
Many Americans aren't. They've heard nothing beyond All Right Now. And people should. They've got a really good, deep body of work.
Yeah. Who else?
The Who, of course, the Stones. I mean, Charlie Watts was an enormous influence on me. The Sensation Alex Harvey Band I loved.
Yeah.
All the good arty glitter stuff. Bowie changed my life.
Yeah.
Creedence Clearwater Revival was that was the first band I ever saw play live. I went with my dad and my brother. We saw them at the Royal Albert Hall. I used to follow bands like Hawkwind around.
Yeah.
Hawkwind were fantastic, sort of pre-punk, trippy, space rock stuff. And the bass player and singer was Lemmy, who started Motorhead. So, but we used to go and see them. Genesis.
Yeah.
Loved Genesis. Yeah. And they went, "What?" No, they were great. And they played at my high school.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. Right after, just after Nursery Crime had come out. Phil Collins had been in the band about 3 months. I loved Roxy Music. I loved reggae, which was seen often by the sort of rock kids as, "Oh, it's fucking pop music, you know, it's on top of the pops." It's great. Reggae was much more sort of integrated and ingrained into British culture than
right.
over here, for all, you know, obvious reasons, but loved it, loved it, loved it. And then, you know, just the Beatles. I mean, one of the first albums we got was Sgt. Pepper and Abbey Road. And you just, we'd lie in bed just with a speaker either side of the bed and just lie there. That's how I'd mostly listen to music.
Yeah,
or with or with a big pair of headphones the size of my head as they were back then, just absorbing it.
Looking at the ceiling, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right.
Yep.
I remember that. Did you ever get to meet any of them?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, what I want to know is who did you not get to meet that you wished you'd gotten a chance to meet?
Bowie. I've been in the same room as him 6 times. I have people who play with him, who work with him for 10 years. He loved Gang of Four. So we were told by the bloody Human League when he hung out with him. But not a... So
why didn't you say hello to him?
Because he was... I don't know. I just didn't want to be a fanboy.
Yeah. I can relate. I get it.
Stupidly.
Would you do that?
Same thing with John Fogerty. I was at a studio in the Valley in L.A. when I was A&R-ing somebody's album, and he was in the next studio, and I just went outside, I don't know, to get something from the car, and he came, and it was sort of funky old Volvo estate wagon, and he comes out, and he, you know, gets something from the car. F*** me, that's John Fogerty. And I didn't say anything, because I thought, you know, I don't want to be uncool. You know? I'm an A&R guy on a record, so I shouldn't be too impressed. And I was, kill myself that I didn't say hello and something. I've hung out with people, you know, good and bad.
Yeah. But you were that close to John Fogerty and to Ringo and didn't quite into Bowie.
Yeah.
Because you were too cool. Really.
It wasn't that I was too
cool.
Were
you shy?
Well, I didn't want to appear uncool.
Right.
I just thought, you know. It wasn't I was too cool. Far from it. Christ, no. I just felt, a little bit shy, a little bit sort of... He's not outside a gig in his headspace for dealing with fans.
Right, right.
So I didn't want to be that guy.
Yeah. I think that there's something to that. Sometimes you look back, I think it was a mistake not to step forward. And sometimes that sounds like maybe
it was a mistake. It was a mistake because I was stupid not to just sort of say something simple and high and whatever. But, you know, lots of other people have, you know, spent half an hour talking to Elton John about toilet paper at Air Studios in London. When we recorded, my other band was recording there. He was in the next studio. And he said, this bloody place, I have to bring my own loo paper, we call it. Because it's softer. And, you know, so, that was funny.
I'm Stephen Mark Voltz, and you're listening to 321 Disaster. Looking back on the managing career and the performing career, what would you do differently?
My managing career, I would have kept a little bit more distance between myself and the artists.
Yeah.
I was too engaged in being their friend.
Yeah.
And not being hard enough. I didn't want to be as aggressive, perhaps business-wise, as I should have been with labels and other people, because I didn't want not to be liked.
Yeah.
It sounds pathetic, but I'm sort of pathetic. I should have been a lot harder.
It's very human.
But I, you know, I wanted to represent the artist, and sometimes it's like, shut up, you're wrong. You know, it encapsulates what I should often have said.
Yeah.
And said, nope, you can't do that. It's not a good decision.
Yeah.
Trust me.
Right.
Let's move on. The one act that I signed that I talked to you earlier about with Kenny McPherson to Island, they got way deep into, there's this new quadraphonic thing and the studio have it, and we need to be ahead of the game. It's like, nobody knows who you are. It only costs another 50 grand on the... And I should write there and said, no. If you sell quarter of a million records, this first one, you can go quadraphonic times two on the next budget. Right. But I was too... I didn't want to be a dick. Right. You have to be a dick to a certain degree as a manager.
Yeah.
Not as much of a dick as Gang of Four's reunion manager was, who's now dead. But, I mean, you can't be over concerned with not being unpopular or people disliking you for decisions you make if you're making the right business decisions. And I didn't put that first too often.
And what about as a performer or as a musician?
As a performer, I did nothing wrong.
Yeah.
I was great. you know.
Yeah.
I loved it.
You're not alone in those reports. Everybody says that. So yeah. Everyone loved it.
I loved being on stage. Yeah. I loved playing. And I was very lucky to play with three fantastic, well, and Sarah, four, yeah. And Buster, five fantastic people.
Yeah.
And, very lucky.
And what about decisions you guys made, business decisions with the band?
We made poor decisions based on sort of arrogance,
yeah.
Of we know better than anyone else, and we can't just do that because it's almost like, well, that's what everyone does, so we shouldn't do it. And it's like sometimes everybody does this because it's the right thing to do, and it is a smart decision. We weren't smart. We were intelligent. We were educated. We were very creative and forward-thinking, but we weren't that smart a lot of the time. Musicians...
So what are a couple of things you would do differently, directing the direction of Gang of Four? Would you go on Top of the Pops?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think we should have handled it better so that a good compromise could have been reached. Yeah. Because honestly, they came back and said, look, you can come back next week, but you just have to do this. And had we not been sort of standing our ground and thinking, look at us, we're in the New Musical Express and Melody Maker, we stood up to Top of the Pops. It's like, yeah, we got a week's good press out of it. And then it was like, yeah. As I think I said last time, EMI went, all right, bugger you lot. We'll work with Duran Duran and get them on Top of the Pops instead. I think that we should have paid much more. When we signed our record deal and our publishing deal, our lawyer, our attorney at the time said, you guys must sign a partnership agreement and you must sign it now. You must come to an agreement. How are you going to do business? No, we're the Four Musketeers. We're never going to betray each other. We're... all for one and one for all, and which was stupid because that led to unhappiness, arguments, loss, and a lot of time going back and forth with some attorneys later on when somebody left, when someone was kicked out. And so again, but that gave me a good thing when I was managing, A&Ring, and then teaching. These are the things that you must do and or must not do if you are going to have a chance.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing to get a chance. It's another thing. You can get into, you can get up to the door and sometimes it's opened, but you've got to step through and stay in the room.
And yeah, and actually and staying in the room is not as easy as you think it is.
People getting a record deal is just the beginning of a very hard and difficult. Yeah. Not that anyone gets record deals anymore, but it's a different thing. I mean, the dynamic now is you are much more independent, self-dependent, you have to build a team because there are are gatekeepers again, but you know it's different. So
it's a lot more self-managed.
I wish we had really known more about publishing, but back then there weren't YouTube videos and books and classes on this is what publishing is. This is what this is.
I've read a lot of quotes from. Of musicians for whom you guys were the influence.
Mm-hmm. All those rich guys?
Yeah, all those rich guys.
Took their ideas and made money on them. Yeah.
How does that feel?
Fantastic. I mean, people you really like, you know, whether it's REM or Chili Peppers or Michael Hutchins from NXS saying, oh, Gang of Four, this guy, you know, it's very rewarding. It's heartening. It's like, wow, cool. it's great to be acknowledged by your peers and people that you like and respect.
Yeah.
You know, when you walk into a room where Pete Townsend's sitting on his own and looks up and, hello, you say, oh, hi, I'm Hugo. I was in Gang of Four. I want to, he said, oh, mate, come and sit down. Fantastic. That was a moment.
That's great.
After that 45 minutes of just the two of us and the result, he did the thing at Berkeley. I left. I said, I got to go. You know, you've got a flight to catch. Lovely, thanks, blah, blah, blah. And I sort of left out the backstage, you know, thanks, everyone. Just sauntering out. I got around the corner and I skipped back to my car. It's like, yeah.
Oh, that's a great story. I want to just end. Bowie was such a big influence on you from when you were Jeff, the tiny baby musician. You had a great remembrance. Do you remember this?
Oh.
When he died.
Yes. Yes.
I'd love to have you just read that.
All right. My brother called me from England at 2:15 this morning. Beau is dead. I was not taken wholly by surprise, but I was a bit sad, thinking as I tried to fall back asleep that I should listen to the new album as I downloaded it on Friday. I reached for my phone and I posted, "Ah, good grief," on Facebook, and then I turned the light out again. When I pulled into my parking space at 6:25 a.m. by the campus in Brookline, this is when I was teaching still, I had to just sit there listening to his voice. It was a replay of an old NPR Fresh Air interview. Then I sort of lost it. It was a good 10 minutes before I swiped my card through the meter and walked to work. I told myself not to spend much time today online. I ignored myself. People are shattered, and I'm shattered too, to be honest. I could write such a lot about his part in my life. I was just at that age when he appeared on Top of the Pops playing Starman. It turned everything on its head for me. Fucking everything. And it changed it all for just about every person I know of my generation who became punks, post-punks, electronica types, whatever. We've all talked about it in the last 46 years. 46 years. My brain hurts a lot. Nobody wasn't changed or moved. And he kept doing it, even with a less than moving period in the 80s, always coming back with music and writing and acting, damn it. I saw him play the Elephant Man on Broadway. Because of him, we heard and listened to so many new and different artists who would never likely have crossed our lines of vision. I still go very quiet whenever I listen to Ryuichi Sakamoto's Avec Piano, and I love Jacques Brel. Many friends have known him, worked for him, played with him. He sent me and my best friend from high school flowers because he heard we'd got a rather severe kicking from some skinheads on the tube coming back from the Rainbow one night after a Mike Garson Woody Woodmansey concert, where we'd hung out in the lobby most of the night with Spider, Trevor Boulder, and Anya Wilson from Main Man, his management company. I hung out with Rhoda Dakar, the Body Snatchers and Specials at these gigs, and an exotic, slightly scary Brixton at parties when I was 17. And neither of us really knew we'd become who we had until years later, on bloody Facebook, of course. She's still a good friend. But I never actually got to meet him. Damn it. "Oh, he loves Gang of Four," we'd hear from those who had actually touched the hem. Another high school friend was his tour manager. For years, sat in the same bar after a show, but I didn't want to be rude because I was talking to my friend and DB was talking to the promoter. I am such an idiot. Been so close and always just too far. It doesn't matter who or what or how old you are, but let me tell you, there are a number of us who really, really were a part of something quite small at first, but that grew like a bastard before long. Who wore the clothes, who hobbled around on the shoes, who put on the slap, who went to the Saturday gigs. That very early Ziggy show at the Rainbow, before it all took off. Lindsay Kemp's troupe dancing, Roxy Music and or Fumble opening. Everyone knowing to do the clap thing in Space Oddity. Him coming out after the encore in a silk kimono to say he loved us, but he hadn't rehearsed any more songs he could play. Oh, David, thank you. You sod making me read that.
I wanted you to read that because so much of that's about your history and your early days. And it was just great to talk to you about the ride you've had and the successes and the cock-ups.
The miserable failures, yeah. Yeah,
it just good. Put it all in a really nice perspective. And since he was such a spark to start your early days.
Yes, he was.
And it was just such a nice remembrance. Well, thank you so much. This has really been really great.
Thank you, Stephen. I've had a blast. Donne-moi l'adresse d'une sirène en détresse. J'ai besoin de soins pour un mal ordinaire.
Et sans ordonnance. Thanks to Hugo Burnham for being my guest today.
and congratulations to him on his recent full-time appointment to the faculty at the School of Performing and Visual Arts at Endicott College. Get ready, Endicott students. If you take Professor Burnham, you're in for a treat. Our theme music, as always, is Maman Original by L.A.W. And thanks to Jim Capillo, Lisa Smith, and the folks at KPAN TV in Gloucester, Massachusetts, newly renamed and rebranded as 1623 Studios, where this interview was recorded. Until next time, this is Stephen Mark Boltz.
Épargnez-moi vos sourires sans rire, relâchez-moi de vos caches sans âge. Je ne suis pas si vieille.
I hope you're enjoying this podcast. I think people may be looking to see what I do as a podcast guy.
No, they're not, buddy. Don't be a wanker.